your patience. I apologize for my late arrival, and we probably will have some additional members of our commission who are going to be joining us, but we will go ahead and get started, and thank you for all being here. We really appreciate it. Before we begin with the items on our agenda, our first item would be see if anyone on the commission has any comments on the minutes from our last meeting in September, or if we have a motion on the minutes. Commissioner, let's see, Wallace. I motion to approve the minutes. Okay, thank you very much. All in favor, say aye. Aye. Any opposed? No? Minutes are approved. Great. And just as an aside, thank you, Gail, for putting these together every month. It's Gail Tilson, who's our administrative support on this commission and does a fabulous job keeping us organized, and the minutes are always very well put together, and we really appreciate your effort. We will go straight to Tammy Getz and your team here from the STEM Action Center, and do you want to come up? And I guess we'll have you introduce the folks who you have with you today.
I'll buy some time to plug in the computer. This is an amazing project that we've been involved with for about 2 years now. It evolved from a grant the National Science Foundation awarded to the National Association for Partnerships and Equity, or NAEP, out in Washington, D.C. And they've been doing this for a number of years, and they award funding to states. We've spent a year doing a root cause analysis of why are we not recruiting, engaging young girls in underserved populations in STEM-related areas, such as computer science, information technology, programming, engineering areas. What I really like about this is it's a root cause analysis, such a great foundation for collecting data. So then in the second year of the project, the partners can go in and make informed and strategic changes in how they teach the classes, how they design curriculum content, so that when they put the effort into it, you're going to see a tremendous effort on Park City's effort to make sure these informed strategic changes, it sets the stage for success to increase the number of girls interested in these areas and other underserved populations, such as Hispanic and Latinos. This project has been going on for 2 years. It's a partnership between the Park City School District, which we decided to pilot with Utah Valley University as a higher education lead on the project. And so the individuals that are here today represent Utah Valley University. We have Dr. Harper Foxman from the School of Education, Utah Valley University, and back, and then Cheryl Hanowitz, and then Dr. Susan Thacker, who are with the College of Computing and Technology. I did that right in the right order. And they were both the state and the university leads on this project. And then the Park City School District, we have Dr. Amber Conley, who is the superintendent of the Park City School District, and then Kathy Einhorn. And Kathy is a deputy, is assistant, is a team associate. One of those. And they both led out the project through Park City School District, working in partnership with Utah Valley University. And this has set a couple of models. One, using data to drive decision making and how teachers are recruited and how they're positioned to do the best job they can for their students. But also, it sets up a wonderful model, in my estimation, of how school districts and higher education partners can work together for the best interest of the students and the teachers. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Amber and let her tell the story this time.
Thank you. I'm going to ask my colleague, Dr. Einhorn, to come up here with me. And since it's a small group, I will say that while we have official titles, we're also known as Lucy and Ethel in our district. And oftentimes we feel like we're on that conveyor belt of eating the chocolates and missing that too. So are we able to plug in?
You should be. You're plugged, but
okay. I'll just unplug it and plug it back in to see if it'll connect. So thank you for that. Just a little bit along the line of what Tammy just mentioned, we have had a wonderful partnership with Utah Valley, and really
they've been so responsive to meeting the needs of our students, but really meeting the needs of all of our students in Utah and being driven with that. I think that you now have the PowerPoint.
Yep. It's up.
It's up? Okay, beautiful. Awesome.
We're good.
So again, it's an honor to be here.
How can show things like that?
She's one of the doors of my life. So, yes, I appreciate that. Thank you. So again, Kathy Einhorn is our associate superintendent for teaching and learning and my sidekick in many of our endeavors. And again, I'm going to say that anytime that our district office administrators see us together, they intervene because they know that we're cooking something. And that we think great things are going to happen, but I often think that they don't. So here we go. As we started this project with Utah Valley, I want to say that I'm a huge believer in systems. And without having correct systems in place to make significant change, we really can't further our work with our children. And that's really what Utah Valley brought in with us through this process. And so what it was a process of what's called a gap analysis that we were able to identify the gaps and the root causes of why we weren't seeing our Hispanics and our females specifically in the science areas. So just a little bit of background on Park City. We are a high-performing district. We've been named the top AP district. Over the last 2 years, have had the top AP students in the state. But as we started digging deeper into our own data, we started finding some very some significant levels that we weren't meeting the needs of our children. So I'll just give you a couple of pieces of data to frame this. Our English language arts, 9% of our Hispanic students were proficient. 9%. And so we started digging down a little bit deeper of, well, how long have they been in our district? You know, maybe they haven't been in our district. And what we found was the average number of years that our students that we had looked at had been in our district was from 9 to 11 years, meaning we had them since the time that they started school. And it really made us take a critical look at our system. How can we be this high-performing district and we are not meeting the needs of all of our students? So we started looking for ways to address that, and we've done some massive changes. And I was just hearing with UVU, and again, I cannot give you enough accolades for their support. But we really started asking, how can we make a significant change? And so this is one of the things that they brought forth. And I'm going to tell you, you have some amazing activists and crusaders in this area right now for Utah Valley of making that significant change. And so they brought in, I'm going to call it the huddle approach. And so it was a gap analysis where our root causes were identified. And we were able to do a deep dive into our data and do a needs assessment. It was very much a team approach. And it was an approach that both higher ed businesses and the public ed came together and started examining what we could do. Well, first of all, where's our gaps? What are our needs, and then let's make a plan accordingly. And I knew that this was a great project because as I have the opportunity to oftentimes step in, step out of training, I can usually gauge the level of engagement and the level of work by what I call the buzz in the room. And every time I walked by the room when they were doing this work, it was active, and they had their heads together in groups as a collaborative approach, looking at our needs and our root causes of why we were getting our Hispanics into science, why they weren't taking the high-level AP courses, why we were graduating and having them go into the fields of science, as well as our females. Where in the world are our females in all of this? And so that's really where Kathy and her team came through. What we found is that we had some a lack of focus. And so when we started looking at our courses that we were offering, it really made us say, you know, we're only given an X amount of money to offer these certain courses. And what is going to give us our biggest bang for our buck to be able to have a streamlined pathway for our students. And then, of course, we found that there was a total underrepresentation of females and minorities in STEM and CTE courses. Here's what we found, too, with our changes. That, of course, our workforce is changing, and we've got to be able to produce high-level knowledge for our students. One of the areas is, well, we weren't marketing it correctly. We weren't saying, here's what we're already offering. We weren't bringing down some of the barriers for our Hispanic students to be in our AP classes and provide support. And I would, after you go through the data, if I haven't, I want to share just a little story about that. We also have a very narrow focus for traditional college prep. So, you know, your AP Lit, I mean, all of those things that were very traditional to get them into our Harvard, Stanford, because we do have a large population that goes to those, but yet that's not representing 30% of our population, which is our Hispanic population. Again, being able to look at what the state requires and then what we really need to offer to get them prepared for college and careers in the tech fields. And then there was just also a student fear. They were scared to take these. They've been told, you know, maybe this isn't the right one for you and had been discouraged through this entire process. So this is also an opportunity for us to work with our counselors, work with our teachers. And then, unfortunately, there's a culture issue that we had to address as far as, you know, this course isn't to them. Well, guess what? They're our students. And so we had to have some really critical, hard conversations with our staff. Again, as I say, only 9% of our students were proficient in English language arts and they've been with us since kindergarten. There was something really wrong with that. And so that's a whole system change, not just in this. And then I would say the other thing that everyone, and I'm going to continue having this conversation at the superintendent level and anytime I can get the ear of legislators, that our current CTE requirements are completely outdated. Some of the assessments that we're having to give from the state office do not come close to matching what they need to be able to enter into the field, but we're required to teach them and required to give these specific courses. So I think at a big state level, what we need to change.
I hate to interrupt you, but could you give us an example of one of those?
I can. We teach pre-engineering, and then we get in. Actually, I'll do the design.
Yeah.
You want to talk about? Do you know
engineering design?
Right.
Yeah.
And so with Jordan Ulrich, what he's required to do.
Well, we've got a teacher we have two who are former engineers who are teaching in the PC Caps and in the engineering program. And what he is doing with his pre-engineering and engineering students doesn't match industry needs. So he's really forced to adapt a model that is put out by CTE, but it is not aligned with what the industry needs. So we're really finding some discrepancies. If we really want to have these courses to help prepare kids to go into the fields, they really need to be aligned with industry needs, we think, right?
And one of the engineering CTE requirements, the assessment for that, I believe, is a system that was used 30 years ago, and they're still testing on it.
So what I did this year, I took our data that we looked at last year as far as the percent of female enrollment in these courses, and we haven't broken it down by demographics yet, but we're still in the process of doing that. And you can see the jump from last year to this year in our percent of female enrollment that we're really encouraged by. I think part of that is due to the fact that we now have 4 females teaching some of the upper level math and science and engineering. We brought in a new woman this year who's also teaching pre-engineering and the robotics. And I think just that, having those female role models, is making a tremendous difference. Another type of data we looked at is our focus group data. And I went out and I had a conversation with our Latinos in Action student. And that was outstanding because what the kids said is, they like and they want the challenges in the school, but oftentimes they feel like the perception is that they're not supposed to be a part of those classes They also said at this point that they didn't feel like they had a way to really learn about careers. They said, we meet with our counselor and we plan out our schedule, but we don't know what people actually do on the job. And they also didn't feel certain about pathways. They had a lot of questions about those. It was fascinating talking to the kids who said, I'm in an AP class, and I'm in there knowing that I may get a C, but I'm going to stay in there because my teacher encouraged me and told me I had the potential to do this. So I thought that was really key, is that we've got teachers helping to change that culture, making sure the kids feel accepted in those classes.
And I wanted to mention specifically because as we started pushing our Hispanic students to be in these AP classes, we started also looking at our grading practices as an entire system. So here's just a quick anecdotal. Had two students, Hispanic student boys, and they passed the AP physics test, with a 3, meaning they passed it, they did really well. When we looked at their grade in the class, the teacher gave them a D. And so it really started conversations around what are grading practices, because this certainly isn't meeting the mastery skills that we're seeing in the content. So something else that we're going to have to fix.
We also looked at survey data, and we surveyed kids in classes that were very representative of the entire school, because we really wanted to know where kids perceive themselves in a lot of these skills. And overall, they're very, very confident that they can do well in language arts, but only 7% saw themselves as not doing well in science, and that was kind of a surprise because we thought, wow, they have the confidence, so it's not that confidence gap that we're missing. It's some choices that they're making that we're going to help guide a little closer this coming year. And we also looked at, in our survey data, information about their interest in fields. And this was very helpful as we selected pathways, because we said, let's match up the teaching we have in place, the teachers, and some of these pathways. So we did take this into account as we started structuring our pathways and realized that we have a lot of classes already in place, just didn't have them in designated pathways. And so what we're in the process of doing right now is eliminating some of what we call the fluff classes. Not to say we don't want well-rounded students, we do, but trying to steer kids more into these pathways and getting them to realize that these are great fields. It was very interesting to see not much interest in mathematics itself. And when we asked students about who do you know that is in a career who's a mathematician, they didn't know very many people who were mathematicians. And I think some of them were missing the connection between the application of mathematics and what people actually do in their careers. So,
and I want to jump in on that too. As this process that UVU offered and that we have been part of, this has also helped us. We're moving toward, we're in the middle of a bond election and getting ready to build a 5-6 school, expanding the high school. And it has helped us define what our schools are going to look like. Because as we look at the expansion, we now know that we're going to need bigger spaces for our biomedical at the high school. We know that our 5-6 school we're using, we're planning to do a problem-based 5-6 school all around inquiry. And so this data and this process has really helped us support the types of learning environments that we're going to build.
I have a couple of questions for you.
Sure.
Tonight. So I want to go back to the responses that you got in the focus groups from the LIU students and the teachers and counselors and kind of the people that should be helping them assess and guide them. It's very frustrating to me. I mean, this is something that I had students that I was with in high school that we were dealing with these same issues in 40 years hence. It's so very frustrating to hear that teachers are still in essence stereotyping students as to which direction they should be going instead of really assessing whether the students themselves are up to speed, and they've got the drive and the interest in it. So I guess my question, my very cabin question is, you say you're having hard conversations with teachers, but what are we doing in terms of like peer assistance, in terms of modeling what the behaviors would be, and modeling how to appropriately assess a student? So you're taking a look at the grading. It is very shocking to hear that a student that has potential is getting B's. That shows a very big disconnect in my mind. And if you have that as an anecdotal experience, to think of how that plays out across the whole population. So I just wanted to have you, if you're going to address it later, that's fine. But I want to dive a little bit deeper on what you're doing in terms of helping to get the teachers to do a different paradigm with the students.
I mean, that's a great, great question.
If
you somewhat address it,
yeah,
I can tag on.
I will. A couple of things we're doing. The STEM pathways are developed, and in fact, Monday, we have a meeting with our school counselors at the secondary level. So that includes both Treasure Mountain Junior High and the high school, so 8 to 12.
Yep.
So they are very knowledgeable about the pathways and can start looking at all of their students and really help directing the students into these pathways, not just based on their SAGE data, because we know that's one piece of the puzzle, but also based on the teacher's recommendations. And what we do know is, and it's coming, I would say surprisingly, but maybe not, from some of our strong female teachers in the sciences and mathematics who are really providing that encouragement for students. So we're using them as a leverage for the other faculty members to say, wait a minute, these students do have the potential. And so these are the pathways that we are putting in place to go into the catalog. We're also pulling parents in to talk to them about the pathways, because we know parents are key. We have a very active Latino parent group in Park City that meets on a regular basis. And so working with that group so they also understand the possibilities for their students. And one of the pieces the parents came out with during one of the last meetings is they want to see coding for their students. They want computer science. And what we were able to tell them is this year we are starting coding. We're starting it with first graders. We've trained all of our technology coaches in coding, and we're using Blockly. I believe that came out of MIT originally, as the method to teach young children coding. And it will work its way up through the elementary ages. We see coding really as a new literacy and as a way to really reshape kids' problem solving and their ability to think creatively and to think in different ways, much like we've seen with our dual language immersion program. So we see both of those as being really great programs for changing what do we think of when we think of elementary school. Another thing we are doing, and it's changing the culture, is implementing the STEM career fair. We started it last year, and we did it after the state STEM fair, because what we said was, we know we need to attract our locals. And in order to attract our local Hispanic families in particular, and their children, we felt like we would have more luck doing it locally. And really, for the first time, we got 150 kids, families, parents. And I think it was key to get the parents in. We did it on a weekend day and partnered again with UVU. We had some of their professors who were doing demonstrations. It was very much hands-on robotics, hands-on demonstrations. And then we had 20-minute sessions, and this followed the survey data, where people in the field actually spoke to the kids and the parents about what they do on the job. And the kids' number one question was always, how much money do you make? Which I think is a great question for kids to ask, but they were very interested in that. They were interested in what kinds of classes they should take. So we are in the process right now of getting our plans together for this year's STEM Fest, because we feel it's so important to really bring in our local community into that project. We're starting
to follow up on that really
quickly. Sure,
so some people that
that both the professors and people in the field, were they diverse? Did you have women?
Very much.
Okay, great.
We did. We went to the Hispanic professionals group, and we had a lot of representatives from the community and outside the community. We really tried to represent women and minorities as presenters, so I think that was really positive. But we know that unless we start early on with kids, we're not going to make changes in this area. So last year we started Engineering is Elementary. It's a program out of the Museum of Boston that teaches engineering design to first graders on up. So every Friday in our schools, elementary schools, is STEM Day. And our PACE teachers, who are our gifted teachers, teach a grade level and engineering unit that is always tied to some event in a country. For example, they study, one unit's focused around Thailand, and they study the tsunami. And how could have structures been built differently to maybe have survived that?
So I want to jump in there. One of the things that Kathy talked about, Cheryl, our gifted and talented specialists, one of the things that we've done is we've looked at our interventions to get high-level engagement and rigor into the classroom. And what we've done is we've done the complete opposite of what other schools have done. We're pulling our reading specialists out of the system, and we've added the gifted and talented specialists because we know that if students are, again, challenged, they will rise to the occasion. And so we have a very specific structure in place for our gifted and talented specialists to work with every single class.
Do you have a question from me?
Sure.
Yep.
Thank you. I'm with the labor unions and women in trades. Senator Carmine just left a few minutes ago. She and I created this Utah Women in the Trades probably 5 years ago. Of course, you haven't finished your presentation, and it's been very enlightening, but I don't see where you have invited anything to the non-traditionals. And not that what we feel, and of course we've been invited with the STEM program, we've been involved with STEM Lockhart and the career fairs and everything, and brought our electricians and all of our plumbers and all the different classes they have to take, and the math and calculus and everything that they need to do. But do you talk to the counselors? I mean, we do not feel that it has to be, oh gosh, you're not going to go to college, so geez, you might as well dig a hole and be a laborer. That's not what we want. We want to be on the same level as that. I'm just wondering if you could address that.
Yeah, absolutely. On the slide that talks about the percentage of females, we had 16% of our females this year in the construction class, had zero last year. I do think part of that is the teacher, who the teacher in all of these instances is key, because they're engaging the kids and getting the kids to realize this is a viable option for you. So definitely that is a route we want to pursue. And I think, again, it's a matter of creating that awareness of what's out there and really taking a look at, you know, four-year college for some kids isn't the end-all and be-all. However, you can get a certificate in that field and have a great career. So we're looking at all those options with kids and talking about not necessarily what do you want to be when you grow up, but what problems do you want to solve. I think that's a very different approach to take with students, and to get them thinking about what's out there that I might want to explore and I might want to have a part in solving. Okay. And the last thing I just wanted to say, as Dr. Connelly said, in getting rid of the reading specials, we're not getting rid of reading, but we have redesigned our elementary reading program so that the teachers are teaching integrated curriculum maps, and they integrate science and social studies. And we do know that with the standards, which personally I think are wonderful, but there's lots of them. We have to integrate the concepts for kids, and we'll make more connections early on. And we've got 14 of our teachers, they're all female right now, working with UVU and our science specialist on the elementary STEM endorsement, 4 from South Summit working with us. And we also feel like that program is going to help move us farther along down the road, too.
Right, and I'm going to just jump in there, too, as well. One of the things that we looked at with our intervention, so our after school and summer school, and what we found was we needed something to really engage our students and give them hands-on learning with the focus that we needed to increase their English language arts proficiency. So we used science as the engagement tool both in summer school and our after school program. And it really just changed the look and the feel of our intervention time with our students, maximizing their learning around this. And I would also just say we have some amazing partnerships, because without the partnerships that we have from our community, we wouldn't be able to be doing this. We have a social impact agreement with United Way, so we use not only their preschool program and that model, which is nationally recognized, so our district in Granite is part of that, but we also, they've been part of our after-school and summer schools, and they have latched on to this whole idea and hoping to put it statewide with how we're using science as the engagement to increase our literacy skills in our students. Again, our partnership with UDU and the STEM endorsement has been phenomenal. I mean, again, you can always tell the engagement level of what's happening in there by the buzz in the room, and when they're there, there's exciting things happening and providing training for our teachers as they get access to our students. The other thing I would get is that with our Latino parent group, we've been able to give them a voice, and so we started having some conversations with our city municipal, and it's been very enlightening for them as far as some of our issues that have so long been, that those are your issues of the school, have now been realized that these are issues of our community. And you know, the poverty issues that we need to address, the educational level for the parents, support for our parents. The People's Health Clinic is such an amazing partnership with us. So that health clinic provides medical care for anyone that doesn't have insurance. And so we're working to be able to do preventative care. We have, and again, I could go on and on, but dental health. Starting at kindergarten, so we had a dental health program with the kindergartners, and they're brushing and flossing their teeth every day after lunch. But I cannot address the partnerships that we've had. Again, going back to this process of identifying our gaps and looking at our needs. So what we're seeing as far as the final pieces with measurement and evaluation is that we do see increased enrollment at the secondary level. But the other thing that I think is most important is that we're starting the awareness in elementary school and starting with refining our focus that we have to do this because it's our economy. We've gone through it. I mean, you guys are living, breathing it just like I am. But the technology revolution is changing our entire world of education. And it's changing at such a rapid rate that we have to be incredibly flexible. And so starting at that K-1, and I want to go back to our coding. We have a partnership with a community member that said coding is so important to me as an individual because he owns his own software company. And he said, I have to have people that are able to walk in and help my business. And so with that, the giving part has been, he's totally funded this program as far as giving us a person to do the professional development with our teachers. But even on a national scale, he wants to do this nationally and give it to school districts free, because it's that moral imperative that he feels so strongly about. And so we're the pilot. We're going through this. We're seeing what's working, what's not working. And then it is going to be able to be available to all public schools throughout the nation. So, again, we're very lucky to have our partnerships with our community. All right, I think I've done my soapbox that I'm sorry. We get up here so excited about the work we're doing, and they know, too, that we know how they have it. Yeah.
Really so interesting, and congratulations on all you're doing. It makes me want to rewind the clock and be 12 years old and move to Park City. That's very exciting. We have a question from Commissioner Barnett.
Thank you. I had the pleasure of meeting your high school, and I had a couple of conferences over there, and it's breathtaking. And your presentation is everybody is impressive as your school district. And I also have a niece, grandniece that's up there in your school district. But just because I think 16% of construction licenses from 0 to 16, that's quite a jump. Without putting you on the spot, why and what kind of a curriculum, what kind of a class was it? Can you just give me a little?
It is an elective GPE credit that the kids are in. And again, I will say that it is a very charismatic teacher who is teaching it, who was able to advertise to the kids, and they signed up for it. And he convinced everyone that it was for anybody, females, males, whoever wanted to be in. And so I think that's great, because one of the concerns the engineering folks have had is kids don't know how to make things anymore. They don't know how to put things together. So the engineering have been very supportive of the construction class too.
And our robotics is all taught by women.
Yep.
And so that's been an interesting, so both at 8, 9, and 10, 11, 12, and all the mentors are, actually that's interesting, they're women as well that have been engineers in the field. And it really is representative of what our robotics is showing, because most of them are girls. So it's really, and they're national robotics champions.
Thank you.
And anytime you want to come up to
the city, we're happy to give tours.
Like, we would love to do that, actually.
Right,
it
really
yeah.
is.
Yeah,
definitely.
I mean, our kindergarten and first graders that are, you know, in the coding piece and working with the STEM learning is just phenomenal.
I just wanted to take 1 minute to wrap it up and kind of a call to action, perhaps. I want to be very transparent about why the STEM Action Center is working with this group. You know, our mandate is to look for best practices, promising best practices that have the ability to be scaled, replicated. And I've been working with this team for the last 2 years. I think we have a process that has gone through the proof of concept stage. And as far as I've been going to Utah State and Big State University, very interested in partnering with their local school districts to do this very process in some of their schools to see what changes they can make. And so one of the STEM Action Center has been working with them. So we're looking for ways that we can scale models like this so that other schools and other kids can benefit from this process. And, you know, and so one of the things I was hoping is that in working with this commission, if you would consider, you know, having a follow-up meeting with us, say how could we support this in phase two scale up? You know, what districts or schools could benefit the most working with Park City districts, who I know are eager to work with other fellow colleagues and districts to see how this could be scaled, replicated and scaled. Just want to put that out there to think about, and perhaps if you're willing to meet in a follow-up conversation.
Absolutely.
See how, I mean, I would love if I could be so bold in this commission to maybe be a champion and advocate for this type of process for other schools in the state.
So I think that is well within one of our discussions that is still here when we talk about our subcommittees. We have a policy subcommittee and research subcommittee, and this could definitely fit into both those discussions, I think, going forward, but we would love to continue.
Okay.
This is an interesting and really very exciting use of kind of those innovative partnerships that I think could scale out, and especially in places, it sounds like the UVU relationship with Park City is kind of new, but you already partnership with a lot of school districts. I know you're heavily involved with the high school in Hoover City, Wasatch High School, and some of those where you're already on site, right, and already providing that CTE relationship is already there, and so you can kind of build upon relationships you already have with some existing high schools, maybe, I'm not sure, but we would love to talk about this going forward.
I appreciate that. And the STEM Action is committed to helping provide support for this year that we're roll out. We're very excited about it. We have been from the beginning. So, in fact, on the state science advisor, we really do to apply for one of these grants. I just never got time to do it. So, I'm excited we're finally a state involved in this project. So, thanks so much for the grant.
Thank you. Thanks for being here. All right, we'll go to our next item on the agenda.
Matthew Weinstein, Emmy Curtis Miller, and Professor Tuhan Wilkinson.
Good morning. Professor Wilkinson is not here.
Okay.
Seattle. Spring break.
Well, we welcome the two of you.
Thank you. Great. My name is Matthew Weinstein. I'm with Voices for Utah Children. And this is Curtis Miller, a student who's been working with us at the University of Utah Economics Department. As you know, Voices for Utah Children has worked for the last 30 years to help create Utah where all children have an equal opportunity to achieve their God-given potential. And we have been very glad to be able to have this partnership with the Economics Department at the University of Utah to work on these more advanced research projects. What we're presenting this morning is very much building on the report that we did earlier this year based on Curtis's work in the fall semester of a year ago that I think folks have seen. And this, nothing in here was really new. It was reconfirming and building on the very impressive work, of course, already done by the Institute for Women's Policy Research with the YWCA, of course, here in Utah. And what we endeavored to do in the next round of this research was to get into this more deeply and to get more into the questions of, well, why do we have this gender gap? Why is it bigger than the rest of the country? What's been the trend over time? How much of it, can you say, is attributed to specific things that we can measure, and how much would be things that we can't measure, which would include the, of course, the discrimination factor that everyone wonders about, how much of it is this, how much of it is that. So I'm going to turn things over to Curtis to introduce himself and tell you a little bit about himself. And what are some of the findings of this research? Is it up on the screen?
Not yet. That's the national number. So again, so I'm Curtis Miller. I'm actually a master's student now at the University of Utah. I teach statistics, and I've worked on this project. This was my thesis project. So, spent a considerable amount of time working on this with Matthew Weinstein and Professor Bildenstroy at the University of Utah, who can't be here for, he's got to be in Seattle for some reason. So, we worked extensively with this. He's approved, and it's been a whole lot of work. The numbers that you're going to see here were probably a lot of work. But without further ado, let's get into it. So what you're seeing here are numbers that you may have seen before in our January reports. So the nationally, women earn 79 cents for every dollar earned by men. In Utah, this equivalent figure is 70 cents for every dollar. This is the fourth largest wage gap in the nation. And the national trend has all everywhere is for the wage gap to close, to slowly get smaller and smaller. In Utah's case, though, while it is getting smaller over time, it's not getting smaller very quickly. Our estimate was that the wage gap would close by 2087, so about like 70 years from now, and 40 years behind the rest of the nation. That was our projection. So, the natural question is, why is this the case? Why is the Utah fare so poorly in terms of wage equity? Is it because of characteristics of Utah women, or perhaps is it because of perhaps there's more wage discrimination in Utah? And we'd like to see if there are possible solutions to improving this. So our analysis basically considers the wage gap as being the sum of two parts. One part is the wage gap that we can attribute to differences in men's and women's average characteristics. So perhaps women tend to be less educated. or perhaps women have an unfavorable occupational distribution. Perhaps they're entering into occupations that don't pay quite as much. Perhaps they're inexperienced, perhaps they're not as attached to the labor force, and so on and so forth. There's all these hypotheses as to why the wage gap might exist. The other part that we break it into is the part that we attribute to employers paying women differently from men, but who are similar in all these other respects. So this would be the part that includes wage discrimination. And it could also include some factors that we have not controlled for, can't control for due to data limitations. So the first part that we describe, the part that we attribute to differences in characteristics, we call the endowment effect throughout this presentation. And the remainder of the part that we attribute to employers paying men and women differently, this is what we call the returns effect. So, as we can move on. So, this is our first set of results. We're basically, we break up the wage gaps at the national level, the regional level, and in Utah. So, so we actually are looking at the male wage premium, right? So, rather than women making less than men, men making more than women, how much men make more than women. So we see that at the national level, men earn 17% more than women. At the regional level, it's 20%. And Utah is the largest at 26.3%. We use this method called the Oaxaca Blinder Decomposition, which, long story short, that does what I described on the last slide. We break this up and into this endowment effect, which is women's characteristics, and this returns effect, which would be the part that includes discrimination. And we find that at the national level, we actually have this, the entire wage gap can be associated with this returns effect, and there's actually a negative endowment effect. If you look into it, you see that women at the national level are actually more educated than men, right? And they actually have a favorable occupational distribution. Now, this is different from Utah, where instead of seeing this negative endowment effect, you see a positive endowment effect. And you also still see this very large returns effect. This is the part that we attribute to discrimination. In fact, most of the wage gap in Utah can be attributed to this. So, moving on to the next slide, we find it difficult to believe there's no labor market discrimination in Utah. We've controlled for quite a few factors, and it seems very difficult for us to conclude that there is none. It seems that this constitutes most of the Utah's wage gap. So, moving on to the next slide. We can actually take this endowment effect that we described earlier and break it down as well. So what we've highlighted here is age and education, and there's also occupation and industrial composition. And what we see is that basically the story is that women in Utah make less due to education, an unfavorable occupational distribution. They're selecting into lower paying occupations, and also they're selecting into lower paying industries. Right? This is actually a very large effect. The industry effect, that's true at the national level, but the education and the occupation factors, that's actually at the opposite of what's happening at the national level. At the national level, you actually see a negative gap associated with education and a negative gap associated with occupation. So this is a very interesting finding as to why it is that Utah actually has a different sign, why it is working the opposite direction. So moving on to the next slide. So the natural question is, why is Utah different from the nation or its neighbors? And as we were able to decompose Utah's wage gap, we're also able to decompose the difference. We can separate it into a part that we can attribute exclusively to differences in men's and women's qualifications, or at least how men and women compare at the national level versus how they compare at the regional level or in Utah. There's also a part that we can attribute exclusively to differences in how men and women are paid, And then there's a, it's not technically correct, it's just subtract one from the other, so we have to take out this interaction term. It's not very interesting on its own, it basically amounts to an accounting difference. So there are these interaction effects. So they, these numbers don't quite sum up like the other ones did. We omitted the interaction terms. So what we see is that most of the difference between the nation and Utah or the region and Utah can be associated with differences in characteristics. So these, this would be the educational differences, the occupational differences, and so on. Now, this, while this chart seems to suggest that there, so here a negative number is good for Utah, right? No, bad for Utah, sorry. It suggests that Utah's gap is worse, right? So in this case, it's saying that Utah's wage gap is like 8.7% bigger than the national gap. And while it would seem that, and, you know, this chart seems to suggest that in terms of discrimination, Utah is better than the rest of the nation or the region, but we got this statistically significant. And some of our more advanced models actually suggest that the opposite is true. So moving on, so we can't really conclude here from these charts that there's a difference in this returns effect, but there's definitely a difference in this endowment effect, that there is a large difference that's associated with women having different characteristics, lower education, occupation, and so on. So moving on. All right, so looking at how Utah has changed over a generation. So we've got, we basically looked at four periods, and we're going to look at the most distant one, the one with the most dramatic change. So we have the 2009 to 2014 period, the contemporary period, versus the 92 to 97 period. And we can basically do the same trick here as we did to when we were comparing Utah's gap to the national or regional gaps. And what we see is that here, in this case, a negative number is a good thing. It basically suggests a decreasing gap over time, right? The national gap has decreased. The regional gap has decreased. Utah's wage gap has not decreased since 92 to 97. And it's very interesting to see why. It looks like that this returns effect, the part that's including discrimination, has improved in Utah. But this endowment effect, this effect that we attribute to differences between men's and women's characteristics, has actually declined. Women's characteristics relative to men have not improved. So basically the story is, and we can see this on the next slide, when we started in 92 to 97, this is just one example, just looking at just education. When we look at 92 to 97, the U.S. men and women have about the same educational attainment, same as in Utah. Then we go to 2009 and 2014. Women, at the national level, women overtake men, right, in terms of their educational attainment. Whereas in Utah, men overtake women, right? So, and actually by this, about the same amount at both levels, but for different genders, which is, we found that an interesting finding, that there is this opposite effect at the national level than the regional level. So, moving on, this was a very advanced project. We showed you a simpler model there, and we did look at some more advanced models. And if you read my paper, you'll actually see one of these more advanced models actually taking center stage. But due to various econometric and statistical phenomena, not all relevant variables are included in the CPS data set. This is the best data set that we can get for Utah. There's issues associated with selection bias, which is differences in how women enter the labor force that could have an impact on their wages. And these more advanced models, it's somewhat difficult to interpret them. They give you more precise estimates of discrimination. The endowment effect is basically the same, but it gives you more precise measurements of discrimination, but they're not very intuitive. There isn't necessarily an academic consensus about how to correctly interpret the results. They don't even really work on the gender gap numbers that we commonly think of, the numbers that are commonly worked and reported in the newspapers and such. So,
Chris?
Yes?
We have a question from Commissioner Berkholder.
Yes.
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Could you go back to the previous slide? Is that possible to do? These are interesting numbers because my understanding is that if you look, the bachelor's degree or higher includes graduate and professional degrees. But
right.
if you take out those graduate and professional degrees, which Utah women do lag behind men,
yes.
women earning bachelor's degrees actually exceed men in Utah. Isn't that correct at all of those levels? There was an earlier study that indicated that, but if the degrees are combined, if you say bachelor's degree or higher, then women do begin to lag behind.
So the numbers that we had in our report from January, which was using the, which data set was that one?
This was American Community Survey.
The ACS instead of CPS, so it's a different data set, but they're both from the Census Bureau.
And this is also a different population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that one found bachelor's degree or higher, Utah men 32.5%, Utah women 30.5%, so women behind 2 points behind men in Utah. But then just looking at the subset of that, that's advanced degrees, Utah men 12%, Utah women 8%.
Yes, that is where there's a big gap. But in terms of Utah men bachelor's degrees, Utah women bachelor's degrees, what is that difference?
So just bachelor's degrees would be 32.5 minus 12, would be 20.5 for Utah men, and for women, 30.3 minus 8, so, okay, so 22.7%. So there you go, right, correct. So the women, more women have bachelor's degrees than men, but if you're doing bachelor's degrees and
Yeah, and that's just an interesting piece of these numbers that I've noticed in the past couple of years, because there's the parallel work that's gone on about the completion rates for women, which is about 10 percentage points lower than the national average for women. So our completion rates are very poor, but if you look at the bachelor's degrees, Utah women are actually higher than Utah men. So
the other interesting thing related to that we found in the January report that we put out was that Utah women are ahead of women nationally up to the point of starting college.
Mm-hmm.
Women in Utah are more likely than nationally to start college, mm-hmm. but that's after that point, Utah women can't fall off.
Thank you.
I think I wasn't quite done with the
okay.
So yeah, we had these more advanced models, and long story short, they say a similar story to what we presented to you here. The one difference is that these models, when you do this correction for selection bias and such, they make a big difference at the national level at accounting for most of that returns effect, but they don't make a big difference in Utah. So what you find is that these models tend to suggest that there's more discrimination in Utah than at the national level. And there's also other methods other than the Sohocke-Blinder method to decompose it, and we didn't really look at those. But there seems to be a common narrative amongst these things, even when you're using more advanced methods. And you can read my paper to get a more accurate description of what's going on. It would take a long time to explain how exactly it works. So our final thoughts, Voices for Utah Children's Free Policy Advocacy Group, so we have some ideas about what could be done. Again, most of the wage gap in Utah can be attributed to this returns effect, which is what includes discrimination. So policies that seek to end direct wage discrimination are certainly welcome. We think that they would, they certainly can't hurt. We may also want to think about methods to improve Utah women's educational attainment. There seems to be this broad consensus that Utah women could think, something needs to be done to help improve Utah women's educational attainment, help them to earn degrees, right, and help them to earn advanced degrees. We could consider looking at workplace practices and other practices and policies that have a disparate impact on women and make it difficult for them to balance education and family responsibilities and make it difficult to balance work and family responsibilities. And this final bullet point is basically working with the gender gap as it is, you know, working, you know, what can we do right now to help women and help their economic situation. And, you know, DWS has done extensive research about intergenerational poverty, people at low income levels and such. And it seems a well-known fact that women and single mothers make up the majority of this demographic. So policies such as the earned income tax credits that help in take-home pay at lower wage levels would certainly be helpful. I think this basically concludes the presentation.
Yeah, the only thing that I would add by way of concluding is that there's definitely room for more research into this. Certainly, as Chris said, additional decomposition methods and other statistical methods, considering the question of the results with the Heckman correction and the selection bias and interpreting those, as well as I know that I've heard that DWS has some interesting working with the University of Utah to actually do surveys of the graduates and track them over time from the various schools there, and could well do the same thing with people graduating from training programs as well, that would see, you know, what's happening with the men, what's happening with the women. That would certainly make a lot of sense to get a better handle in a very Utah-specific way of what's happening over time with these populations. So thanks very much, and we're very happy to answer any questions that folks might have.
Thank you. We do have some questions. Excuse me. Commissioner Barnett.
Thank you. Thank you, Curtis. This is very, not really enlightening. I think we've seen the information before, as sad as it is. My question to you personally is, what made you decide to take on this paper for your...
Well, we did this project back in, basically at the same time last year, on gender gap numbers and, you know, conversations with Professor Bilden School. I suggested we can use these methods to try to say more about the wage gap. And, you know, even just after we released this report, looking on what people were commenting on the internet about the report and some of the concerns that they were having, you know, this, you know, questions that they were having, you know, that helped motivate, you know, diving into this project.
But in your own personal life, mother, sister, friend, neighbor, you've never had a conversation really with anyone personally? Because it's been a great report that you've done. Mm-hmm. But for you personally, you don't have any, couldn't really say that.
My mother just, she just teaches music out of her home. She's a private music teacher. Right. And, so not really.
Thank you for the report. Thank you very much.
Any other questions from the commission? Commissioner Burkholder.
Thank you. Thank you for this report. It was really interesting. This is a question for Matthew Weinstein. I think because of the focus of this particular commission, the work that's being done on the earned income tax credit is important for us to understand. So my question is whether you could briefly tell the commission what is going on at the state level or what is not going on at the state level in terms of earned income tax credits. And do you see any role for this commission in advocating for that?
Sure. So the earned income tax credit is a federal policy that was created under President Ford in 1975. And then expanded by President Reagan in the 1980s and by every subsequent president. And it has sort of always been framed as the conservative alternative to raising minimum wage. The debate among the economists has always been, should we raise the minimum wage to help lower income workers? And the concern has been that puts a burden on businesses, especially small businesses, and is there a way to do it that wouldn't have that effect? and that's where the idea of the Earned Income Tax Credit was developed, and has been intended to encourage and reward work. There have been dozens of studies since it's been in effect so long, and it's developed into the largest policy we have in the entire country to help give a boost to lower wage workers. It's been the subject of dozens of academic studies that have found that it has a very powerful effect on encouraging lower income workers to go into the workforce, stay in the workforce, so it promotes independence and work effort. It also has been found to have a tremendous positive effect in terms of health outcomes and educational outcomes for the children of these families, as well as they've been able to follow it to the next generation and found that the children of people who receive the EITC themselves are more likely to enter the workforce and to work longer hours and to earn more higher wages. So it's something that's been found to be a genuine multi-generational strategy for addressing poverty by rewarding work and encouraging work. And so it's now not only been expanded at the federal level, it's also a policy that's been now applied in 26 states, and in fact has been expanded. It's most recently, for example, in New Jersey, Governor Chris Christie just expanded the New Jersey Earned Income Tax Credit by 50% from the 20% of the federal to 30% of the federal. In Utah, it's something that's been debated for quite a few years, as I understand it, and a proposal to create a 5% EITC in the state of Utah. Passed in the House of Representatives in 2013 and 2014, sponsored by Representative Eric Hutchins, but it has never passed in the state Senate. It just didn't get a vote those 2 years. And there's always been the question of, well, how do we finance it? Because it has about a $25 million price tag to do 5% in the EITC. So that's been the debate. And our argument certainly has been that given the positive impact it has on encouraging work, rewarding work, encouraging independence, as well as the way that it disproportionately benefits women, and by, in effect, raising their take-home pay at the bottom level, since the disproportionate share of low-income workers are women, a disproportionate share of poor children are in those households, it's a policy that would, in particular, benefit the state in this area.
If I could just follow up and suggest that the public policy committee of the commission discuss this further to see whether at some point during the commission's life it would make sense to look more closely at the EITC at the state level, knowing that women do make up the majority of lower wage workers, and this is a mechanism to reward and encourage work. This seems very much germane to our larger concerns.
Definitely. Thank you for that suggestion.
I see no additional questions. I just have a favor to request of both you and our previous presenters from Park City and Stem. If you could share your PowerPoint presentation with Gail, I'd love to have that shared with the commission, and we're going to look to start putting some of these great pieces of information that we're getting on a website that we're putting together, which we'll talk about in a minute. But such great information that we've heard today from both of our presenting groups, and want to share that information far and wide as best we can. So thank you very much for all of your work on this, both of our presenting groups.
Okay. Oh, sorry.
And I would apologize for the other meeting, but I'm trying on the voice for youth children. And I don't know if you spoke about whether there was any piece on healthcare and, you know, the disparity for women, low income women, which I believe just explained most of them are. either working women and their Medicaid expansion component. I don't know if that was discussed in that presentation.
Well, we didn't mention that, but it certainly is a policy that has been shown, and the states have done it, to take a lot of financial pressure off of lower-income families, reduce medical bankruptcies, so there's no question that that would also give a boost to lower-income households and disproportionately have that impact on women and children.
Okay. And, you know, the reason why I mentioned that is because it's not part of our conversation, but as we, you know, get ready to potentially discuss the what we have right now as a proposal, which to me is not a Medicaid expansion, but whatever they call that. There is a very specific piece to children of removing them from SHIP and Medicaid as part of the policy, which I've, you know, I've heard of, and I've never seen a waiver provided to something like that, and that has a direct impact, especially those families that may have, you know, those children and moms and you know, women. And I haven't seen voices for the children's position on that, but it's one of those very scary, you know, ideas that you will have to, you know, remove your kids from those programs that we know provide a very robust program for children. So I haven't seen their position, but again, just as a side note, if we're talking about the financial stability for women and their children, and this is a direct impact on that by forcing them to remove their kids from those programs in order to have an adult parent receive any type of coverage, which I think is penalizing children in a very unfortunate way.
Yeah, and I would defer to my colleagues, Lincoln Nearing, our CEO, and Jesse Mandel, our health policy person. They would know more about that particular area than I do. I know that we're very much supporting the proposal for 12-month continuous eligibility for children on Medicaid in Utah, so they wouldn't be going off and on. But once they're on, they are on for 12 months continuously, which I believe has about a $5 million price tag, something that has been shown to have beneficial effects for children.
Thank you.
Thank you for your opinion. Thank you both very much. And before we move to a quick report from each of our committees, our subcommittee working groups, I do want to let the commission know that Commissioner Eiling has resigned from the commission, challenges with work commitments and making the daytime meetings precipitated her a recent resignation, so Chair Edwards and I will be working on jumping in to go replace her and Heather Varnum, who we still need to replace from our small business representation. But that's why we don't have to be here with us today. And we have thanked her for her service, and we'll keep you up to speed on what's happening with that. So, that being said, I do want to move to subcommittee reports. So we'll go ahead and start with research. Commissioner Robinson, if you want to give us an update as to where we're at with that particular committee. Oh, and then Chair Edwards needs to leave for a committee, our meeting that she has previously committed to. Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a lot of updates for you. I know that we're working with the communications subcommittee to get content for the website, and we will have a lot of content that will be available for the website shortly. I think it might be this Thursday, am I right? Other than that, we're really again still in a holding pattern waiting to hear about our grant application. I'll quickly do a report on policy because I think the lion's share of work that's been done over the last month or so has been done by our communications committee. Two things that I wanted to bring up as one of the folks that serves on the policy committee. I quickly drafted some ideas for policy guidelines, and these are extremely, extremely rough. And I went back and forth with Chair Edwards as to whether we wanted to share those today, but I think I want to go ahead and share them just as kind of fodder for brainstorming in your own minds as to how we might want to address issues of policy. I think the point that Commissioner Burkholder just made related to EITC is a good one, but trying to figure out what type of frame do we utilize as we evaluate various policy recommendations that come before us.
The other thing that I wanted to throw out there for everyone to consider is to give us feedback on, particularly the chairs since we both sit on the policy subcommittee, is if you hear of bills that people are running that you think might fit within the frame and work and purpose of this commission, or our agencies that we're working with, you've got appropriations or anything along those lines that you feel does fit very effectively or appropriately with what we do, please let us know. We've got a couple more months to kind of vet some of these ideas, and I want to spend a lot of the time in November and December, and even if we can squeeze one more meeting in January before the session starts, to really start thinking about policy recommendations and appropriations that might be coming our way that the commission could take a stance on as we kind of tweak and finalize the principles, and I see that merging with where the communications committee is going with the website and kind of some of these artist efforts to get additional information out. So I'm just going to pass these two. I won't go through them right now because we're limited on time. I really do want to spend more time on the website. But take a look at them. I'll also send them to you electronically. And one thing that I thought of, you know, even as I sent them out, is I post them as questions. Maybe we do them as statements versus questions. I haven't really focused on research per se, more on very global type of frames. But I'm definitely open for feedback and input based on other models that you've seen or how you see the work of this commission moving forward. And that is basically it for the Public Policy Committee. And then let's move to communications. Commissioner Wallace, let me get your mic up and going. Oh, we have a that's you right there.
And I am happy to report that the Communications Committee has been put back together, and that we have had many meetings about the website since our last commission meeting, so I wanted to share that with the rest of the commissioners as well. The committee right now is made up of three people, which we're adding to. That includes myself as chair, Barbara Munoz, who you met last month, who is a policy analyst for Community Action Partnership with Utah, and also Olga Doro Cruz. She's with the Utah Hispanic Chamber. We did right, move forward with a student from LPS Business College, but she was not able to commit to time. However, we are looking for younger women or men to assist us with this, and also thinking about contacts that would come from media and professional communications. So I know Barbara has had experience in communications in the past. I have not, but we are moving forward. So what we want to do right now is to work on a website for our commission, not just the one from DWS, but our own committed website to provide information to our community and our constituents and our supporters. We met with, and that would include the co-chairs as well as the subcommittee co-chairs, which includes Jennifer Robinson. We met together with Utah Interactive, who's the company contracted with the state of Utah to do all websites, and met with them about our needs and our ideas about what we want to have on this website, and they're willing to do and put together this website, including a logo for the commission, at no cost to us, which is fantastic. It's part of their agreement with the state of Utah to offer pro bono services, so this falls under that. We did request a basic layout of what we want the website to look like. They gave us some options to look at, and I've actually selected the option for our website that is both on the desktop as well as our other devices. So what we presented to them and what we have chosen is to have a main banner at the top and three subcategories underneath. I don't know if you see this, but this is a representation. This is a wire frame that they sent over to us. So our website will have rotating banners at the very top with our maybe our guiding principles. The three below will include our three subcommittees. So it will include policy, research, and then in the news. I don't know, not sure what we're going to need that one, but and then basic information at the very bottom. I have already asked all of you for your bios and pictures. Thank you for sending them. They'll go right onto the website. They are requesting of us content, the content format, which I should be sending them today or tomorrow. And then, as Commissioner Robinson had mentioned, content is coming from the subcommittee for their page that will be accessed from the main page. And one thing that we wanted to make sure was that all the photos were high quality, high resolution, but most importantly, of Utah women, not stock photography.
So as we work with our commissioners and subcommittees, we'll request photography, and we may need to branch out into these organizations, and maybe even those who have presented to us to get those photos so that they're of Utah women doing all sorts of things in their lives, not just employment, but also being mothers and contributes to our community. So we hope that will be where we start. After that, our priority will be the strategy, and we hope to have someone from media to help us with the three things I mentioned before about being proactive, as well as predictive when we need to be, when reports come out, and educating our community. One thing that I don't think I mentioned this to any of the subcommittee chairs, but we do want the voice and messaging of this website to be a young voice. So, of course, we talk about millennials, but they don't need to be called millennials, but we want a millennial voice for this website. Is there any questions about the website or any suggestions? I forgot to mention the device format will just be a scrolling, I guess they're stacked. So each one of them will be stacked. There won't be any columns on the devices when it's Melissa is used. So it's just white down to the bottom. So. Any questions about the website? I forgot deadlines. The content is due this week, and Utah Interactive has made it clear that they can work on it and have it up by the end of November.
Commissioner Robinson has a question.
I'm going to offer up some help to Commissioner Walsh. I have a photographer lined up that would do the pro bono photos for you.
Okay.
This is incredible. I love Commissioner Barnett.
I'm excited for the website. I'm like, tell me what the young voice means. What does that mean? Yes, I know this one on this commission. What does the young voice mean? Enlightening, please.
Right. So this is a website or the voice and messaging that a younger person would identify with. The style of the website is going to be clean and easy to access, easy to use. And I guess maybe even some of the verbiage we use to describe things would be something that maybe those who are in college would be able to understand very easily and be attracted to listen, to watch, and to find out more information about. I hope that answers your question.
And I think if there is, and Commissioner, I think that what I might be sensing that the concern might be, and don't, you know, be free to clarify, but I don't think we're trying to be exclusive across people, with people at various stages of life that want to be looking to opportunity. But I think that we, in particular, want to, especially for young people who may not see the challenges that are present because of gender inequity, speak to them and help be a bit more overt about who we are. I think maybe some of our contemporaries are very clear as to what the challenges are sometimes, but sometimes our young people may not see those as clear and present challenges. So we want to initially speak to them, but I don't think it's necessarily going to be exclusive to women across the various stages of life where they may be looking for a resource that speaks to them. So I don't think we're going to necessarily exclude representation, especially like in the photos, et cetera. But it's more about what it visually looks like and how it speaks to them.
What I'm envisioning is, as a grandmother and as a mother, perhaps looking on it for resources for a daughter, granddaughter, so that it isn't just the young folks that would be looking on it. And I'm very pleased with what you've been doing, and you're extremely, you know, you're pushing to get everything done, and I love it. I just do. You're very organized, and I know you're extremely busy, and I appreciate all your time. Thank you so much, Henry.
Commissioner Wallace.
Commissioner Wallace. Yeah, I just wanted to thank Henry publicly for her all the work that's gone into this. She's done a magnificent job, and I'm really pleased with the design and the look of the website. I think it touches on what you were saying, that this needs to have a look that's very appealing to a younger audience. So you are cutting edge on the website, and Utah Interactive needs to be thanked as well publicly for giving us this at a pro bono rate. It's quite expensive, and it's time consuming. So thank you.
Thank you. one of our flowers talking out kudos. Thank you, Commissioner Robinson, for linking this up and thinking of that as a resource. Because, and I think that that's what this is all about, is finding where our resources are, which is what something that I think most of us are really good at doing, and bringing those resources to bear to the work of the commission. That'll help Commissioner Representative Edwards and I, as we make our appeal to our colleagues to continue the commission, to show that we're leveraging other resources and it's not just us asking for more, but that we're utilizing the resources that we all have to bear upon the capacity for this group to move forward. And so, yes, Commissioner Wallace, thank you for re-energizing that committee again and getting things rolling. Any other comments or questions for the commission before we move on? Yes, Commissioner Wallace.
Maybe to go right on.
Yeah.
I did forget to mention the URL. That's kind of important. We actually requested and looked at other states' URLs for the Women Economy Commissions, whatever their names are, and what we decided to go with and is available and we will have is women.utah.gov.
Well, that says it all.
Oh,
thank
my
you.
Golly, how lucky we are.
Yay.
Wow.
Okay.
You
all
are
right.
Lucky. Wow.
No confusion on that one, is there?
We want to make sure that it was something that women could find easily, and also if they could guess in their heads what it could be before they even looked it up.
Again, great words. Thank you again for our presenters, and we know we have some folks in the audience that joined us for additional information, so thank you for joining us and listening to our presentation today. Any other business other than that, I will entertain a final motion. Thank you, Commissioner Robinson. All those in favor? Thank you.